This recording was made at the Structure and Style Teachers Conference in Tacoma, Washington, July 2004.
Well, I am thrilled to be here. Thank you for allowing me to come and share with you today, to have a discussion together about literature. What I'd like to do today is encourage you to write about literature. I'd like to encourage you to teach your students to write about literature. And I'm also here to tell you why I think that. Because I think we encounter some resistance when we say, you know, what we really ought to be doing is reading classic literature and writing about that. There's an instinctive question that pops up in discussions like that frequently, and it goes something like this. Why? Why should we read classic literature? Why should we read the Iliad, for example, of Homer, about people who lived thousands of years ago and have nothing in common with us whatsoever? So what I'd like to do today is begin by offering you an apologia for literature, a justification for studying, reading, thinking about, understanding, and most importantly, writing about literature. Why? Why should you read literature? Why should you study it? So let me take a minute or two as we get started to offer you a justification. To experience literature is to see the world through new eyes. The essayist C.S. Lewis in the last century said, "My own eyes are not enough for me. I would see through those of others." When we read, we broaden our perspective so that we're no longer trapped within the limits of our own experience. Lewis says in another place, "When I read great literature, I become 1,000 men and yet remain myself. I see with a myriad eyes. It is still I who see. I transcend myself and am never more myself than when I do." One of the reasons to read great literature is because we can be more than we are. We can actually be in places we've never been. We can see vistas we've never seen. We can experience things beyond the limits of our time and place. Great literature beautifully portrays the tragedy, the pathos, the wonder of the human condition. And because it does this and does it well, I submit to you today that great literature is an end in and of itself. It is a tool for teaching the skill of debate. It's a tool for teaching the skill of critical thinking. It's a tool for teaching all manner of important skills. But it's also art. Literature is art. And as such, it richly rewards educated contemplation. Literature is art that richly rewards educated contemplation. Let me ask you a question. Why do you go to an art museum and look at a Rembrandt? Does anybody know? Somebody offer me an answer. Why do you go look at a Rembrandt at an art museum? Has anyone ever done it? Okay. Very good. To see in person what you've seen in pictures. To experience it firsthand. In other words, one of the reasons you go to an art museum is to experience what the art is in and of itself. To stand in front of it would be the way that I would put it. The reason you go look at a Rembrandt is so that you can stand in front of a Rembrandt for a while. Right? And then once you've done that, you're done. That's why you went. I would draw the connection between literature and painting in the same way. Literature, in a way, is an end in and of itself. Literature represents the contributions of its authors to a conversation, a great conversation, in the words of Mortimer Adler, a great conversation about ideas, about the relationship between the human and the divine, about what's good and true and beautiful. Literature is the place that intelligent people all down through the ages of history have gone to talk about ideas, to talk about what it means to be human in this world and what makes a good human life. And to experience literature is to participate in that great conversation. The pleasure, the fulfillment that come from reading literature in this way, I think is part of what it is to be human in the fullest sense. It's what sets us apart from animals, that and opposable thumbs. Just those two things, I would say. At Westover Academy, where I teach up in Northeast Washington, we had the high school students read Hamlet this last year. The question, let me ask the question of Hamlet. Why should you want your students to read Hamlet? Why? Well, let me answer before you have an answer in your mind. Let me tell you what I think. So that your students will have the chance to think critically about literature, to think critically about life, to think critically about how to stage a five-act play, perhaps. All those things are true, but listen to this reason. So that by the end of the quarter, they will have read Hamlet. Right? That's why you have them read Hamlet, because in reading Hamlet, they will see and understand in all its beauty and tragedy and glory the plight of the human soul. So they will see themselves mirrored in Hamlet's nobility and heroism, in his anxiety and indecision, in his glory and his destruction. So their minds will be uplifted beyond the facts of their own experience in the 21st century in Northeast Washington to a level of, to a world of ideas, so that they will eventually bring to their own lives a depth of understanding, a sense of perspective that would not have been available to them had they not read Hamlet. A long way of saying, I want them to read Hamlet so they'll be more complete as people because of standing in front of it for a while. You know, it's an odd and, to me anyway, kind of a disturbing thought that most of us will be utterly forgotten by history within 50 years of our deaths. Just think about that for a while. How many people do you know that were alive 100 years ago? How many people do you know of that were alive 100 years ago? How many names can you name of people that lived 500 years ago? You history teachers in the crowd can probably name a list, right? Maybe 100 people. Tops. Most of us can't name anybody that lived 500 years ago. You are sailing on a road into anonymity right now. That's just a little disturbing to me. Maybe it's because of my age. Maybe I'm starting to enter midlife and wondering and worrying about those sorts of things. Achilles, however, lives 3,000 years, 8,000 years, however long it's been, after his death. Hamlet lives. Huckleberry Finn lives. Augustine of the Confessions, Hawthorne's Hester Prynne, Dostoevsky's Grand Inquisitor, they are immortal, in a manner of speaking. Why is that? It's because there's something about them, something about those people, be it the bitterness of Achilles, the repentance of Augustine, the tortured humanity of Hamlet, or the earthy wisdom of Huckleberry Finn, something about those people that touches us in our humanness, in that place in our souls where we are human beings, something that touches us in there and calls out to us and bids us answer. Something that mirrors our own glorious potential, our own sinful wretchedness. These characters have the power to move us, to inspire us, to ennoble us. I would submit that these characters, these people, are the gifts of God to men. And he who would know God, not only in his heart, but in his mind, would do well to meet him in literature. This is why we should read and understand and write about literature. The world is filled with gifts of beauty, truth, goodness. And among these gifts, I would submit to you, are authors philosophers, poets. To understand their work is to understand, and in a real way, the goodness of God. This is why you should do it. This is why you should have your writing program lead into writing about something specific, writing about literature, writing about ideas. That's my apologia. But you might be asking yourself another question. Okay, fine, I agree. I'm sold. Literature, let's do it. How? I got the why figured out, but how in the world am I supposed to teach literature to my students? I didn't have a master's degree in literature when it was my turn. I don't know the first thing about literature. When I get done reading a book, my only question is, did I like it? And the answer is a one-word answer, yes or no, and that's the end of the conversation, right? Why did you like it? Well, I don't know. I just liked it. And we know enough to know that this is not a good direction for the conversation to be going, right? How in the world do you get your students to analyze, interpret, understand difficult literature? Has anybody ever read William Faulkner? Anybody ever turned the pages in The Sound and the Fury? I started reading The Sound and the Fury once, and I read the first chapter, and it made no sense whatsoever. I mean, not that I didn't get the themes. I couldn't understand the words. I couldn't put the sentences together. It's because it was the first part of the book is the record of an addled mind, and he did that on purpose. I didn't know that. I just thought, this is crazy, and threw it over my shoulder. And I think that's what a lot of us do. I was talking to a friend in my neighborhood once. He said, I tried to read Hamlet once, threw it away in the middle of Act 1. Haven't picked it up since. Ridiculous! The whole thing was ridiculous. Well, we all sort of feel that way a little bit. Literature is full of deep, dark secrets, right? There's tricks to understanding and interpreting literature that unless you have some secret knowledge yourself, you don't know. And therefore, you can't pass on to your own students. Those of us who had literature classes in college or in high school, did we hate them? Some of you might have liked them. I hated them. There was a big mystery involved, and I didn't get it, and I didn't care to get it. One of the reasons I think we all hated literature, those of us who did, is because of something called the lecture format, which is what you all are involved in right this minute. You sit there in this desk as a passive receptor of knowledge, and I stand up here as the deliverer of knowledge, the dispenser of knowledge. Your job is to write down everything I say. So get going. Or at least the good things that I say, and remember them for some testing opportunity later, after which your job is to forget them all. Exactly. No, everybody knows deep down in their hearts, this is not the way to learn anything. Everybody knows deep down in their hearts that most of the time when you're involved in a situation like that, you're wasting your time. And we all thought that when we took literature classes, and so literature equals waste of time. Today I want to talk about a different format for teaching literature, teaching your kids to write about literature. And we call it a Socratic method. We use the term Socratic method in a specific way and rather loosely as a result of questions and answers rather than lectures. Discussions about literature that happen as the result of questions and answers rather than lectures. We prefer this method over the lecture format for a variety of reasons, but the most obvious one is that when there's a question and answer session led by somebody who knows where the discussion is going, everyone is involved. Even inexperienced students can be drawn into the discussion, and they are learning something as they participate in a discussion like that. They're learning how to think, learning how to have an opinion, back it up with a piece of evidence, articulate it verbally, orally, out loud. Have a little give and take on it if the teacher disagrees or if another student disagrees. They're learning how to think in the context of a discussion about literature. And the thing they're learning to think about is an idea. Something important. Something about the nature of the human soul and what it's doing on this earth and how you can make a good human life out of it. a discussion about literature will hopefully produce, and I want to go through one with you today and have a little give and take and talk about how to set one up, hopefully produce thinking about literature, thinking clearly, understanding the goals and purpose of the author, and then as the final product of these two processes, writing about literature and the ideas contained therein with grace and eloquence and power. I have a handout that I would like to give you. There are some handouts, obviously, in that binder that Andrew mentioned, but I made another one in the time between I sent those to him via email and when I showed up today. And it's an example of an essay written by a student of mine, an 11-year-old, about Huckleberry Finn. I'm not going to go over it right this minute, but I want to pass it out to you quickly so that when it does come time, we can just quickly turn to it. So if I could take just a second and do that. In fact, if I just give you this, will it go around? Thank you. Andrew gave me a book in June, last month, I guess, book to read by Oliver Vandermill called The Thomas Jefferson Education. Has he pushed that book off on any of you, too? It's out there on the table. I just highly recommend it. Not that I need to. He's probably already done so during the course of this conference. But I highly recommend it because the author of that book, Oliver Vandermill, talks about a couple of the ideas that are really important to me as well. And I always like to read books that are about ideas that are important to me, where the author agrees with me. And he talks about three different kinds of education. If you all have read that, you'll remember. There's the kind of education designed to prevent the student from growing up indigent. Then there's the kind of education designed to produce a skilled technician in a particular field, like medicine or law or engineering. And then there's a third kind of education, which he calls Thomas Jefferson education, which is designed to produce leaders in society, designed to produce statesmen, for example. And he talks about the different components of these three types of education and isolates as the defining component of a leadership education that students in this kind of education have a facility with ideas, that they be able to handle ideas clearly and well and express themselves about ideas with grace and eloquence and power. We found that the way to begin getting this kind of education for our students is to discuss literature with them in a question and answer format. Now, I'm just trying to anticipate your next thought, which is, oh, great, you haven't made it easier at all. If anything, it's more difficult now, because now I have to figure out what questions to ask. I have to be ahead of my students in another way. I have to know exactly what questions to ask them about the particular book we're reading so that they will end up as statesmen. This is never going to work. So what we've done is trying to come up with a way to get people involved in asking their students about literature so that the students come to a clear understanding whether or not the teachers are already experts in literary analysis and interpretation. So I want to share with you some of the ideas that make this a doable process, that make this a reachable goal for you to take students that don't know anything about literature, be their teacher who doesn't necessarily know anything about literature either, and get started on a literary education for both of you. So turn to the handout, not the one I just passed out, but the one in your binder in the section called Andrews, I think. And you'll notice an odd-looking oval with a triangle covered up with a bunch of other ovals. I want to talk about three ideas that will help you get started discussing literature. Idea number one, and if I could, I don't know if this is going to work on the camera, but let me just write this up here real quick. Idea number one. Oh, great. It's disappearing. Okay, forget I did that. Edit that out of the tape. I'll read it to you. All stories have the same elements. All stories have the same elements. This is a very simple idea, but it gets simpler. The elements themselves are not hard. They're not secret. They don't require graduate degrees of any kind. They are written on the handout, right here. At least I hope they are. Does your handout have bold-faced words? Okay. At the bottom of the oval, there should be the bold-faced word conflict. Above it, above the line, there should be the bold-faced word plot. P-L-O-T, plot. So if there isn't, you can write it in. In the center oval, in the very middle of the diagram, should be the bold-faced word theme. As in, I want you to write a theme. Yes, theme is the oval in the middle, right in the very center of the diagram. It's the kind of a small one. On the upper left, in the region between the big oval and the triangle, setting. Is that one already there? Okay. And then characters on the other side, is that there as well? Okay. So if you have all those written in, you should have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Five ovals that don't have anything in them or that have small little italicized words in them. They're blank. Okay, fine. We can work with that. These are the five elements that all stories have in common. All stories have a conflict, plot, setting, characters, and theme. If something doesn't have these five elements, whether or not it's a story is kind of an open question. This is what makes a story. So what I'd like to do is talk about what those five elements are, and then talk about how we can use those in discussions of literature. So let me just go through them and have you take notes on that diagram, if you like, about what I mean by those five terms. Okay? Let's start with conflict at the bottom of the diagram. You can probably fill this in yourself. This is not a difficult concept at all. The conflict in a story is the tension, the misunderstanding that has to be worked out, the obstacle between the main character and his goal, the disagreement right at the root of the story. By some ways of looking at it, conflict is the most important ingredient in any story, and you could make the case that unless a story has conflict, it isn't a story at all. I often tell the anecdote of a writing student of mine whom I gave a horrible assignment to. I actually said to her and to the whole class, write me a story. Go. You writing teachers know not to do that, but I didn't. So I did it anyway, made that assignment. And so she went, oh, goody! And she grabbed a whole ream of notebook paper and a pen and just went after it. And she turned in a 15-page story that went something like this. Once upon a time, there was a beautiful princess. She lived in a beautiful kingdom, in a beautiful castle, and was the daughter of a beautiful king and queen who loved her very much. She grew up to be a lovely, beautiful girl. But suddenly one day along came a beautiful prince on a beautiful white horse, swept her up in his strong arms and whisked her away to an even more beautiful castle, were that possible, where she lived a beautiful life, happily ever after, the end. That's a distillation. She used the word beautiful even more than that. 15 pages worth. And I said, this story is beautiful. It's wonderful. You get an A+ for effort, but it's a D story. I didn't tell her this. This is just the truth, because it isn't a story at all. What's missing? There's nothing bad that happens, right? There's no friction, no tension, no conflict. Conflict is what makes a story go. Let's move up to the diagram one step to plot. You all know what plot is. It's a common English word. And then the technical top secret literary definition, the master's degree, doctorate in literature degree definition of plot is this. It's what happens in the story. It's what happens in the story. Now, we can get slightly more technical by dividing the plot of a story up into five parts. And those five blank ovals are the five parts of the plot. So I'm going to give you a word to put in each of those, and you can describe it in your own words as you go. On the bottom left-hand corner, it should have said exposition. Exposition. This is the part of the story where the author exposes to the reader his imaginary world that he's created, that he is now going to talk about for the length of his story. He exposes to the reader things like where the story's going to happen and who are the people that are going to have the action of the story happen amongst them. Gets the reader into his little world. The next oval up, if you follow the little diagonal arrow there, should be called rising action. Rising action. In this section of a story, the characters encounter a conflict. Remember, we said that conflict is the essential ingredient. It has to happen sometime. In the rising action section, the characters encounter a conflict, and events take place as a result of the conflict that have the effect of heightening the tension of the story. They happen in sort of a chain reaction style until the tension is so great that something has to give. Which brings us to the top of the triangle, which should be called climax. And the climax is the highest point of a story's tension. The moment at which the something that has to give actually does. The moment where the reader goes, aha, that's how it's going to turn out. The moment when it becomes clear that the conflict will be resolved one way or another. One of the great things to do when you're discussing a story like this is to have a discussion with your students about where the conflict ought to be located. What point in the story represents, the climax. What point in the story represents the climax of the story? Where does it all, what moment does it all hinge on? After that moment, things are sort of settled in a way that they weren't beforehand. The climax. The next one, down the side, on the right-hand side, you can call falling action. Or if you want to get fancy, you can use the French word denouement. D-E-N-O-U-E-M-E-N-T. And this is the section in the story where the tension that was building up in the rising action part is now draining away. Now the questions that were in the reader's mind get their answers. The mysteries that the reader struggled with are solved. All the pieces are put in place. Everybody gets married off, for example, in Great Expectations, and they pair up and go have lives together, that kind of thing. The falling action, or denouement. The final oval there is called conclusion. And this is where the author basically says, in effect, okay, I quit. That's enough about this story. I'm going to move on to another one. And perhaps he constructs a final scene where the characters have one more thing to say to the reader. Perhaps he puts a little spin on the story's events and gives you his own interpretation. Maybe fires one more time across the bow his moral of the story. And then it's over. These five components of the plot are common to all stories. They have various lengths. Sometimes the rising action is 90% of the story and everything else is crammed in around the edges. But all those elements are there. Knowing this is a powerful tool for having discussions about literature because you can say to your students, what happens in the exposition? And you can have discussions just about the structure of the story based on the fact that no matter what story you read, these elements are there. Let me jump up and talk about setting and characters quickly. Setting there on the left-hand side of the diagram. Somebody tell me what the setting of the story is. Just raise your hand and shout it. What does setting mean? Time and place. Very good. The setting of a story is the time and place in which the story happens. How many people, when you hear that, think, the time and place? Boring. That's the end of that question. Move on to the next question. This story happens in 1942 in Ohio. How is it that I'm analyzing and interpreting literature right now? Well, what else happened in 1942 in Ohio? Anything? there was a war on, for example. Do you think that might have anything to do with what's going on in the story? Do details about the setting actually have bearing on what's happening in the story? All kinds of avenues of discussion can spring up from the very simple question, when does this story happen? Huckleberry Finn, for example, is a great, great tool to use in this. Does anybody know when Huckleberry Finn is set? 1830s. Okay? In America in the 1830s. Does anybody know when it was written? 1880s. Exactly right. Written in the 1880s. Any significant events in world history happened between the setting and the writing of Huckleberry Finn? The Civil War. Do you suppose that's significant? The story of Huckleberry Finn is written about people who live in the American South during slavery, by someone who lived after that question was settled politically in our country. Oh man, what a powerful detail. If you talk about that for a minute and ask some of the questions that I'm going to be suggesting that you ask, all of a sudden, we've got a discussion about real, honest-to-goodness ideas just from a question about the setting of the story. Okay, across there on the right-hand side of the diagram, characters. Obviously, characters are the people in the story. And a good discussion about literature can do more than just identify them and describe them. But it can talk about them as people, relate to them from the perspective of the student in the class, whether he would like them or not and why, discuss how they relate to each other and to their environment. And finally, in the middle of the diagram, the word theme is the final element of all stories. And let me just give you a quick definition of theme. Theme is the main idea of the story. I used to hesitate to say that because, again, it sounds like I'm not saying anything new. The main idea of the story. But I'm not saying anything new. Really, honest to goodness, it's a simple deal. The main idea of the story could be described as the reason the author sat down and wrote it in the first place. The underlying question that the author was trying to grapple with. The underlying problem that the author couldn't get around, and so what he did instead was sit down and write a novel about it. Anybody read Anna Karenina by Leo Tolstoy? Adultery. What do you do about it? How are you supposed to think about adultery? What happens with adultery? What kind of repercussions does adultery have? This is troubling to Leo Tolstoy. You just can't get over it. What is the relationship? What's the parallel between adultery and false religion? Boy, I think that just sounds like there's parallels there. Oh, man, I can't get over it. I need to write a novel. Some of us don't do that. Right? Some of us just say, ugh, and then we move on. But not great geniuses like Tolstoy. He sat down and wrote one of the greatest novels ever because of his struggle with a particular theme, adultery, false religion. So that's the idea about theme. Okay? Now, the first thing I want to communicate to you is that all stories have these same elements. My second idea that I won't even go ahead and try and write, I'll just tell it to you. Number two, the same set of general questions can be asked of any story so as to bring these elements to light. The same set of general questions can be asked of any story so as to bring these elements to light. In the syllabus for our literature seminar, we have published an extensive list of questions. We call it the Socratic list just because of the fact that it's designed to get discussion going about literature. And I've included excerpts from that list in your handout. So you can turn there for a moment if you'd like. And I want you to notice the different kinds of questions that you could ask. I've listed some questions for each of the five elements of fiction that I've just described to you. On the first page there are three questions about plot, and then one about conflict. On the next page, there's some questions about setting and characters, and then on the third page, some questions about theme. They range from very simple questions, like, for instance, question number one, what happens in the story? Obviously, these questions are great if you're talking about a book with 8-year-olds. If you're talking about a book with your second grade class. Some of the questions, some of those sub-questions underneath are more complex and are designed to have you have discussions with older students. Look at the one for conflict, for example. Question number 4, what does the protagonist want? Might have to stop and explain the word protagonist, but we've found that if one of our students comes up against a real difficult word, and we stop and explain it to him, he kind of has fun saying it over and over to himself. My son Aaron's favorite word is onomatopoeia, yeah, which is a top secret literary interpretation word. So what does the protagonist want? A simple young student level question. But look at the bottom one there in number 4C. Is the conflict an external one having to do with circumstances in the protagonist's physical world, or is it an internal conflict taking place in his mind and emotions? How about question number 7 on setting? When does this story happen? Simple version. But what about letter B? In what time of life for the main characters do the events occur? Are they children? Are they just passing into adulthood? Are they already grown-ups? Does setting the story in this particular time of the characters' lives make the story better? Has anyone ever read To Kill a Mockingbird by Harper Lee? During what time of the main character's life do the events in that story take place? Say a little bit louder. Childhood, but also in a coming-of-age time. Childhood passing into maybe not adulthood, but a little bit more mature version of childhood at least, right? Is it important that it happened right at that cusp of that new stage in her development? Absolutely. Absolutely. In fact, one of the main themes of that story resonates with the idea of coming of age, right? A great discussion could be had with very little preparation beforehand even about the idea of coming of age. What does it mean to come of age? To become an adult? Were more people in To Kill a Mockingbird coming of age than just Scout? Was the whole country coming of age, perhaps? Anyway, I'm going to ask you some of these questions in just a moment about a specific story. And I just want you to know that none of these questions are specific to a particular book. One of the reasons maybe that we struggle teaching literature is that what we have to teach it with in terms of curriculum, oftentimes, is an old-fashioned study guide. Who knows about an old-fashioned study guide? What does it contain? Comprehension questions and vocabulary lists. And the third thing they sometimes contain is enrichment projects, right? So if you're reading a story about pioneers, you build a log cabin out of dowel rods, right? But the comprehension questions themselves are entirely specific to the book you're reading, so that if you want to read more than one book, you need more than one study guide. And there's also very little attention paid to the kind of things that are common to all stories. The kinds of things that allow students not just to think about the one story that they're reading, but to think about the larger issues that bind all stories together. The larger issues that bind all people together. Like coming of age, or bitterness, or loyalty, or friendship. Yes, ma'am? While it's being read, you mean? Okay. I almost always advise people to have the kids read the book first and read it all the way through and then discuss it while it's still fresh. Yeah. Obviously, sometimes in a classroom situation where there's a school administration in place and progress reports are due and there has to be weekly evidence of work being done, that's difficult. And I think actually the vocabulary tests are useful for that. But in terms of a discussion about the ideas of a book, it sure seems to make more sense to me to read it first and then talk about it as a unit. So, the questions on this list are not specific. They are general, generic even, although that's sort of a derogatory type word, but useful, I'd like to say, for more than one book. And the point of them is to get the kids involved in thinking. Now, my third idea. Idea number 1, all stories have the same elements. Idea number 2, the same set of general questions can be used for them all. Idea number 3, children's stories are a great place to start. Children's stories are a great place to start. I loved one of the things that Mrs. Ingham said earlier today about bringing the things down to the level of the student and making sure he can relate to them on his own level before you try to overload him with a bunch of stuff that's over his head. We don't want to talk about the themes of literature to kids who are going to be completely overwhelmed by it. We don't want to talk about Huckleberry Finn for a kid who's not ready to read it. We don't want to talk about Anna Karenina, for goodness sakes, till they're grown-ups. Right? There's issues of subject matter, for goodness sakes. Why not read books with your students that are right at or below, as Andrew's fond of saying, at or below their reading level to prepare them to succeed every time out, and discuss the elements of fiction as they appear in books at their own level, since, if my first principle is right, those elements of fiction are present. So I'd like to do that with you today. Read you a story, ask you some of the questions from the Socratic list that I've included, and we're going to put it up on that second story chart that I gave you that's still blank. Now, raise your hand if you do not like having stories read to you. Raise your hand if this is irritating. I didn't think so. Everybody likes having stories read to them, right? Of course you do. It's because we're human beings. That's why the Iliad was written, by the way, or at least made up, so people could sit around the fire and have a story told to them, right? I'm going to read you a children's story, and you're going to love it. It's by Patricia Polacco, and it's called Thunder Cake. Raise your hand if you've read it before. Oh, good. What I'm going to do is read it to you. I could show you the pictures because they're just great, but I don't know. What is it? Does it look good? It does? Really? You can see them? All right. I'll show you the pictures too then. What I'd like you to do is think about the five elements of fiction as we read through this story. What are they? Conflict, plot, which includes exposition, rising action, climax, denouement, and conclusion. Setting, characters, theme. Okay? And then I'll ask some questions to get us to think about those a little bit more specifically as we go. So, sit back and think and listen and enjoy. Thunder Cake by Patricia Polacco. Grandma looked at the horizon, drew a deep breath, and said, "This is Thunder Cake baking weather, all right. Looks like a storm coming." "Child, you come out from under that bed. It's only thunder you're hearing," my grandma said. The air was hot, heavy, and damp. A loud clap of thunder shook the house, rattled the windows, and made me grab her close. "Steady, child," she cooed. "Unless you let go of me, we won't be able to make a thunder cake today." "Thunder cake?" I stammered as I hugged her even closer. "Don't pay attention to that old thunder, except to see how close the storm is getting. When you see the lightning, start counting real slow. When you hear the thunder, stop counting. That number is how many miles away the storm is, understand? We need to know how far away the storm is so we have time to make the cake and get it into the oven before the storm comes, or it won't be a real thunder cake." Her eyes surveyed the black clouds away off in the distance. Then she strode into the kitchen. Her worn hands pulled a thick book from the shelf above the wood stove. "Let's find that recipe, child," she crowed as she lovingly fingered the grease-stained pages to a creased spot. "Here it is, thunder cake." She carefully penned the ingredients on a piece of notepaper. "Now, let's gather all the things we'll need," she exclaimed as she scurried towards the back door. We were by the barn door when a huge bolt of lightning flashed. I started counting like Grandma told me to. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. Boom! The thunder roared. 10 miles. "It's 10 miles away," Grandma said as she looked at the sky. "About an hour away, I'd say. You'll have to hurry, child. Gather them eggs, careful-like," she said. Eggs from mean old Nellie Peck Hen. I was scared. I knew she would try to peck me. "I'm here. She won't hurt you. Just get them eggs," Grandma said softly. The lightning flashed again. 1, 2, 3, 4, five, six, seven, eight, nine, I counted. 9 miles, Grandma reminded me. Milk was next. Milk from old Kit Cow. As Grandma milked her, Kit Cow turned and looked mean right at me. I was scared. She looked so big. Zip went the lightning. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, I counted. Boom went the thunder. 8 miles, child, Grandma croaked. Now we have to get chocolate and sugar and flour from the dry shed. I was scared as we walked down the path from the farmhouse through tangleweed woods to the dry shed. Suddenly the lightning slit the sky. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, I counted. Boom, ba-boom, crashed the thunder. It scared me a lot, but I kept walking with Grandma. Another jagged edge of lightning flashed as I crept into the dry shed. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, I counted. Crackle, crackle, boom, the thunder bellowed. It was dark, and I was scared. I'm here, child, Grandma said softly from the doorway. Hurry now. We haven't got much time. We've got everything but the secret ingredient. 3 overripe tomatoes and some strawberries, Grandma whispered as she squinted at the list. I climbed up high on the trellis. The ground looked a long way down. I was scared. I'm here, child, she said. Her voice was steady and soft. You won't fall. I reached 3 luscious tomatoes while she picked strawberries. Lightning again. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, I counted. Kabang, boom, baroom, the thunder growled. We hurried back to the house and the warm kitchen, and we measured the ingredients. I poured them into the mixing bowl while Grandma mixed. I churned butter for the frosting and melted chocolate. Finally, we poured the batter into the cake pans and put them into the oven together. Lightning lit the kitchen. I only counted to 3, and the thunder rumbled and crashed. 3 miles away, Grandma said, and the cake is in the oven. We made it. We'll have a real thunder cake. As we waited for the cake, Grandma looked out the window for a long time. Why, you weren't afraid of thunder. You're too brave, she said as she looked right at me. I'm not brave, Grandma, I said. I was under the bed, remember? But you got out from under it, she answered. And you got eggs from mean old Nellie Peck Hen. You got milk from old Kit Cow. You went through tangleweed woods to the dry shed. You climbed the trellis in the backyard. From where I sit, only a very brave person could have done all those things. I thought and thought as the storm rumbled closer. She was right. I was brave. Brave people can't be afraid of a sound, child, she said, as we spread out the tablecloth and set the table. When we were done, we hurried into the kitchen to take the cake out of the oven. After the cake had cooled, we frosted it. Just then, the lightning flashed, and this time it lit the whole sky. And even before the last flash had faded, the thunder rolled and boomed and crashed and ba-ba-ba-ba-roomed just above us. The storm was here. Perfect, Grandma cooed. Just perfect. She beamed as she added the last strawberry to the glistening chocolate frosting on top of our thunder cake. The end. Oh, wait a minute, it's not the end. One more page. As rain poured down on our roof, Grandma cut a wedge for each of us. She poured us steaming cups of tea from the samovar. When the thunder roared above us so hard it shook the windows and rattled the dishes in the cupboards, we just smiled and ate our thunder cake. From that time on, I never feared the voice of thunder again. The end. Okay. Now, admittedly, that is not Pulitzer Prize-winning, graduate school level adult literature, right? However, I want you to notice it is prize-winning literature. It just happens to be written for children. This has some very great advantages to the teacher of literature. Number one, to write something for children, it's necessary to make it very, very clear, right? And when you're looking for material for lessons for your students, teaching them how to think, how important is clarity? If you can find something really, really clear, you've found something, haven't you? Let's talk about Thundercake from the perspective of the five elements of fiction. And I'm going to ask for participation from the group, so don't be shy about raising your hand and speaking up. Let's talk about, first of all, plot. Okay, the five circles that go up and down the triangle in the middle of the diagram. Now, you don't have the book in front of you, so I'm going to ask you to remember. What do you learn in the exposition of this story? What do you learn in the exposition part of this story?
A little girl with her grandmother.
A little girl with her grandmother.
On a farm.
On a farm.
And there's a storm coming.
A little girl with her grandmother on a farm, and there's a storm coming. Something good to do for as a writing exercise even for the plot part of a story chart like this is to have the student summarize in one grammatically correct, chock full of meaning sentence the exposition of the story. Sometimes you give them a word limit. In 8 words or less, in one sentence with a subject, a predicate, a capital letter, and a period, I want you to describe the exposition of this story. So you can say something like, on a farm, comma, a little girl and her grandmother await a thunderstorm. It's probably more than 8, isn't it? You'd have to work on it. Choose your words carefully. They'd have to decide between one word and another. They'd have to make fine distinctions. Choose one word that's better over a word that's not quite as good. What are they doing when they're practicing that? Learn how to think. Learning how to be precise. Becoming leaders. Future statesmen. One step at a time. Okay, so we've got an exposition. What about the rising action? Remember, rising action is where the characters encounter some sort of conflict and events take place that heighten the tension. Nice and loud. Okay, good. But even before that detail, the cake has to be cooked before the storm comes. Sharon. Okay, good. We could summarize those two things by saying they decide to make a cake, right? They decide to make a thunder cake, and then they race to finish it before the storm comes. Okay, good summary.
She's afraid of the storm.
Yeah, she's afraid of the
good. Before you even talk about what they're going to do, but there has to be a conflict, right? Now, there's several conflicts going on here. One of them is they're trying to finish the cake before the storm comes. But another one is she's afraid. She's afraid of coming thunder. She hides under the bed. Right? Okay? What events happen in the story that increase the tension as we go along? Nice and loud. The storm gets closer. Very good. The storm gets closer. And what did you say? And they count. The whole repetition of that counting thing heightens the tension, doesn't it? And the reader standing up in the front of the room screaming at the top of his lungs, that heightens it too, I suppose. Good. Very good. If you want to have a writing exercise that's a little bit more in-depth, you could have a student describe in a whole paragraph the rising action of the story. The question for the assignment could be, what events take place as a result of the main conflict in this story that have the effect of increasing tension to a breaking point? And you could talk about the step-by-step way that the author takes the tension to higher levels by the different parts of the farm that she has to go to get certain things for the cake. And they get worse and worse and worse until finally she's climbing up things on the side of the house. Okay? Now, the climactic moment. What in your mind is the climactic moment? And this is a follow-up question for every question you ask in a discussion about literature. Why do you choose this? Why did you give that answer? Who has a climactic moment in their mind that they think is the one it all sort of hinges on? Okay? When they get the cake in the oven. Let's see. Doesn't Grandma say something about that? 3 miles away, Grandma said, and the cake is in the oven. We made it! We'll have a real thunder cake. What is decided at that point in the story? What conflict is decided? The conflict of whether they're going to get the cake done in time is over, right? There's a climax of that particular conflict. Now, go ahead. Yes, ma'am.
The part that the child is scared.
Very good. If the conflict you're interested in is the fear of this child that she's trying to overcome, then another climax moment might be when she realizes, hey, wait a minute, I wasn't scared. And that conflict is overcome. And what? And the part that you mentioned was what? The grandmother asks a rhetorical question. You're unafraid of thunder. You're too brave, she said, as she looked right at me. Yeah, and then she goes on to explain. You got out from under the bed. You climbed the trellis. You went down the dark, blah, 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 blah. Good. So you know, as the reader, that conflict is solved. If that was your conflict, you might also have chosen a section or a point in the story slightly later where she has the thought herself, she was right. I was brave. You could pick that point and say, the most important detail is that the protagonist of the story realizes that she's overcome her fear. And that's when there's some resolution. Great literature discussions can happen, not just with children's books, of course, but with adult fiction about what the climax of the story is. Because if you locate the climax of a story in a certain place, you are making that decision based on assumptions you already have about what the story's about. For instance, this climax here, when we got the cake in the oven, choosing that climactic moment means that you think the story is about getting the cake in the oven. That's the central idea, right? Getting the cake in the oven. Choosing this climax up here gives away the fact that your central conflict, what you think the story is really about, is the fear of the little girl and her overcoming the fear. Now, obviously, a writer can have more than one plan, and some of the great books are great because they do both of those things at once. But the important thing is to have your students thinking along those lines. We're doing literary analysis right now. This is all it is. Okay? What about denouement or falling action? What happens in the falling action part? Some of that I left out, I think. They eat the cake. Very good. They eat the cake. What else? You could include that, couldn't you? You can include that in the falling action, where the little girl internalizes it and says, oh yeah, I'm a brave girl. Okay? And how about conclusion? Oh, there's one more thing in the denouement. The storm actually arrives, doesn't it? Does it arrive with the violence that she was thinking it would arrive with to begin? I mean, it's loud, but it's no big deal, right? It's a storm over the house. I'm inside eating thunder cake with my grandma. Two grown-ups. Right? Did we talk about conclusion? What would you say on conclusion? Remember, conclusion is where the author gives you one more idea, one more thought to go home with. Oh, the conclusion. What is it? I was never afraid of thunder again. Right. So you know how the characters are when you leave and go on to read a different book. You remember the characters in a particular way. The conclusion of Huckleberry Finn, since I mentioned it before, just a great one. Huckleberry Finn says, at the very end, he says, you know, Widow Douglas is going to get me and civilize me again, and I got to light out for territory ahead of the rest because I've been there before. And so you know, after you've read Huckleberry Finn, you've digested its themes, when you think back on that book because of its poignant conclusion, you know that Huck is still out there somewhere in the wilderness following the dictates of his conscience no matter what the world tells him. And it gives you a little warm feeling inside. Maybe. Or not, but you can defend yourself, and so it doesn't matter. Okay, mention to me, we've talked about conflict and plot, and those two things are really related together and tied in closely together. Talk to me about the setting real quick. Just a couple of details about setting. Let me ask you a question from the list here. Question number 6, where does this story happen? On a farm. In the country, in the summertime, during a storm. Very good. Okay, how about this question? What is the mood or atmosphere? This is question number B, 6B. What is the mood or atmosphere of the place where the story happens? Do we know anything in this group about choosing quality adjectives for things? Does the phrase quality adjective ring any bells in this room? Here's a great place to make a long list of quality adjectives for the mood or atmosphere of the story, of the atmosphere of the place where this story happens. Is it cheerful, sunny, dark, bleak? Give me one. What would you say? Oppressive. That's a good one. Threatening. Protective. Is that what you said? Why do you say that? Because of the grandmother. Keep talking. What do you mean?
Every time the child was afraid,
Mm-hmm. So the whole... I'm right here, child, she croaked. Yeah. Yes. Good. Do you suppose those details were put in there by that author on purpose? Absolutely. You can always go to a story assuming the author meant it, did it on purpose. And so those details are put in there carefully in order to create that atmosphere. Yes? A symbol of home and yeah, good. One more question about setting. In what time of life for the main characters do the events of this story occur? Are they children? Are they passing into adulthood? Are they already grown-ups? They're children. Is it important? Is it important that the main character be a child? Yes, because we grown-ups, most of us, are not afraid of thunder, right? Yeah, I am too. I wasn't going to say anything. Are they just passing into adulthood? No. But is there something of that flavor of the coming of age? Yeah. Right. You don't have to pass into adulthood to pass, right? You can pass into something else without having to be a grown-up by the time you're done. Yeah? How would you describe this character? Give me a quality adjective to describe the main character of this story. Trusting?
Endearing.
Good. Endearing? Why would you say that, Doreen?
Because she's so simple and straightforward, admitting her weakness, her fear, admitting her fear.
Uh-huh. Good. That's right. I was scared. I was really scared.
Honest.
Yeah. Good. A mentor figure. Good. Great. Great. If you are unaccustomed to asking questions about literature, what I hope you can do is use these basic ideas to get started. And what happens if you get going a little bit and you have a story that your children are interested in, that your students are interested in, a discussion can kind of go of its own weight. It can sort of have a momentum of its own. And you can stick close to a list of questions like this, like the ones that we provide in our seminar, or you can ask questions back and forth as the Spirit moves you, and you begin to talk about the themes of the story. Yes, go ahead.
My question is, why tomatoes?
Yeah.
When they put the trellis, was it to go up the trellis to get closer to the thunder and the lightning?
Oh.
I mean, I don't put tomatoes.
I'm sorry, my fault again. There's a recipe for thunder cake in the back, and it includes tomatoes.
Really?
And it's good. We made it. I'm sure most of the people who read this go make it, don't they? Yeah. It's really good. The tomatoes are juicy and wah. A little tangy, adds a little zip. I recommend it. The secret ingredient, she called it. Okay, last question. All of your discussions of literature should eventually point to theme, that final component of fiction, because in general, I'm going to make a blanket statement here. I always get in trouble for doing this, but I think this one's right. An author rarely sits down to write a story unless he is dealing with a theme of some kind. You rarely sit down to write a story just to say, I think I'll write a story. Those are the kind of stories that nobody but the author ever reads. So, every story's got a theme of some kind, and the author had it in mind. What is it? What is this story about? That would be the simple version of the theme question. Okay, one at a time, nice and loud. Okay, say it one more time, I didn't quite hear you.
Fear must be faced.
Fear must be faced. Okay, good. That's a good one. Now, that is a, what's that? A sentence in the imperative mood, right? Face your fear, right? And sentences in the imperative mood have the character of morals just a little bit, right? This is how you ought to do. This is how things ought to be. And a moral and a theme are similar, but not necessarily the same. You can talk about the theme of a story, and it doesn't have to have a didactic character at all. You could just say, for instance, that the theme of this story is overcoming fear. Right? Which doesn't necessarily say that the author is trying to tell you to think about it one way or the other, although he or she often is. Overcoming fear or facing your fear. What's another theme of the story? Okay. So a theme there could be the love between family members. Right? The love between family members. What else? Yeah. That little psychological trick, right? Of diverting, distracting attention from something unpleasant. Oh. Yeah. Great. So the theme of the story would be my awesome grandmother, right? In fact, Polacco, if you know the author, he does that a lot with figures in her life that have helped her along. She was a slow reader, for example, and she wrote a great story sort of in praise of the teacher that taught her how to read. And yeah, very good. Now, a question that you may be asking is, okay, this certainly works with a picture book, and I brought a couple more picture books. I don't have time to look at them. Bedtime for Francis. It works great with Bedtime for Francis. Brave Irene by William Steig works like a charm with Brave Irene. What about Huckleberry Finn? Arguably the greatest American novel ever written, written for grown-ups about serious grown-up issues, full of technical literary tricks and deep ideas. Does this kind of discussion and analysis work for Huckleberry Finn? More important question may be, can you use this kind of discussion and analysis techniques together with a writing program like the one we're involved in to produce clear and eloquent prose? So I've included an essay by Ian, who is 11 years old, that is the product of both the Institute for Excellence in Writing and our method of literary analysis and interpretation. And I just want you to notice it's a discussion of theme, which, remember, I mentioned a minute ago, is the ultimate goal of a Socratic discussion about literature, to get students interacting with the main themes of the story. And raise your hand for me if you have read Huckleberry Finn. Good. If you've read Huckleberry Finn, I read it as a child, as a young boy, before I knew how to think about literature. And it was just a great adventure story. And I loved the stories, and I loved the great characters, and the dialect, and all that kind of stuff. I didn't think about theme at all, and you can certainly read it at that level. But how much better to prepare your students for a lifetime of discussing ideas, a lifetime of interacting with what mankind has always interacted with since the beginning of civilization. Let me just read it to you real quick. Mark Twain had very specific ideas about a great many things. However, he voiced one of his most valued opinions in his book, Huckleberry Finn. In this book, Twain explored the meaning of slavery and freedom. He queried, what does it mean to be free, and what does it mean to be a slave? As Huck journeys down the Mississippi River with an escaped slave, the conflict in his soul becomes more apparent. Should he be helping Jim escape, or was it right that Jim be a prisoner because of his color? Huck has lived as a ragamuffin all his life. The backwoods are his home. Because of his secluded life, the moral ideals of society are never imprinted on his brain. Instead, God's ideals and the voice of his conscience goad him on. This is the basis for the mental battles he encounters along the way. In his heart, Huck knows that slavery is wrong and that Jim is no lesser man than he. But the little that he knows of society tells him to return Jim to his master and be done with the whole business. The little voice in Huck's mind continually battles with society until Huck can stand it no more. He resolves that if helping Jim means going to hell, then that's where he's headed. Huck's decision reveals Twain's own ideas about the issue. Obviously, Twain believes very strongly that no man should be enslaved and that all men should be equal. Twain uses the character Huck, his friend Jim, and their journey as a mask for his theme. In addition, Twain believed that society imprisoned itself. For instance, even though she could do anything she wanted, Miss Watson was really more of a slave than Huck. Huck thought it was very binding to have to wear stiff clothes and to live in a house, but his mind was free to wander the paths of the forest, blissfully unaware of political issues. Miss Watson, however, was fully chained in her intellect by her social ideals. Society, which Huck had never been a part of, was a slave master to all in its grip. Miss Watson, caught up in the claw, was burdened by the demanding overseer, society. But Huck was running, not yet caught, which is why he was still engrossed in the problems of a simple mind and soul. Society chained the mind and spirit. Twain was an amazing author. The troubles and big ideas of his times had an effect on his stories. Because of that influence, most of Twain's themes are deep and important. While they are hard to discover, they are important to comprehend. Slavery is an abhorrence to God. The idea that black Americans are inferior won't hold water any more than a sieve. All men are equal, and that's the way God meant it to be. Without God's voice in our lives, we don't have a chance against the enslaving voices of the social order. Not bad. When I was 11, I was not thinking that way about Huckleberry Finn. I was thinking this way. Sure would be cool to sail down the Mississippi River on a raft, right? Now, in fairness, Ian thinks that too about a raft, and it would be really cool. But in the context of an assignment where it's time to discuss the ideas, because he's familiar with the elements of fiction, because he's familiar with a question and answer format where his responsibility is discussion, he's able to interact with these ideas in this way. So I recommend, once as in closing, before I take questions if you want, I recommend literature to you so highly. The pleasure and fulfillment that awaits you and your students from interacting with it is beyond words. Thank you very much.